Obama heads north. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama travels to Alaska to shine a spotlight on issues affecting the Arctic, starting with climate change.
The president and the White House, they really are trying to focus Americans on what's happening up here. And what's happening up here really is dire.
Plus, could artificial trees really help lower CO2 emissions?
They stand passively in the wind, and as the air blows over it, they absorb the CO2 out of it.
And later, how Germany tries to manage the flow of migrants across its borders.
Germany's message is pretty clear. We will take in anyone who is fleeing war or persecution, but people who are fleeing poverty, we simply cannot take everyone in, so that's where the line is drawn.
The stories today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you're looking for President Obama this week, leave a message. He'll be in the Arctic. Today, Obama embarked on a 3-day tour of Alaska, where he'll venture north of the Arctic Circle. That'll be a first for a sitting president. His focus will be on how a warmer climate is changing the far north. The president will be attending an international conference that is dealing with that. It is a big, big deal. Melting ice is increasingly opening up the region to shipping and oil drilling. But the U.S. lags behind other nations like Russia in pressing its claims on the Arctic. Anchorage-based reporter Elizabeth Arnold recently had the chance to hop aboard a Russian icebreaker in the Chukchi Sea between Alaska and Siberia. She says she immediately noticed something.
There are definitely more vessels transiting this area than you would think, and that's largely because there's less ice.
You know, several years now, Russia, Canada, Norway especially, have been hot on the Arctic. And the U.S. seems almost to be taking a back seat. I mean, you can just see that in the sheer numbers of icebreakers. Why is that, though?
Well, let's just talk about the conference that's coming up right now. We have not really even, we didn't even attend these meetings for at least 13 years. The first person to attend one of these meetings, even though we are an Arctic nation, was Hillary Clinton. But we're starting to now. In terms of territory, we can't submit claims because we haven't signed the Law of the Sea. We'd have a much stronger hand if we would ratify that treaty, which we initiated, but that's been stalled in the Senate, where some are loath to join anything that has anything to do with the UN. So far, Russia's been the most aggressive in terms of pursuing claims. However, Denmark, Norway, and Canada are also submitting claims to the UN that all involve the North Pole.
We've kind of seen a split personality when it comes to climate change with the Obama administration. He goes up to the Arctic, as he is now, to draw attention to climate change, but also he allows Shell to drill up there. Is the U.S. lagging behind because it's part of the argument to leave the Arctic alone, leave fossil fuels in the ground? But then how does that square with giving permission to Shell to drill?
Well, he doesn't see it that way. He sees it that basically he's up here trying to get people to focus on the dire consequences of climate change. And yes, he's given the go-ahead to Shell, but they say we need new sources of domestic oil for a gradual transition from dependence on fossil fuels. But, you know, it is risky. You know, I was out on this icebreaker for a couple of weeks, and it was, you know, 20-foot seas. There's a storm out in the Chukchi this past week that Shell suspended drilling. The coast has been just pounded by the storm surge. Kerry described it as a test, this drilling. He said he's always been leery of offshore drilling, but in this case, the leases were sold, and the president believes it can be done in a safe way, but that Shell has to prove itself.
What do you think, Elizabeth, is the key piece here of this story for people to keep in mind over the next 3 days with Obama up in the Arctic?
You know, I think what's happening here, there's a lot of talk about legacy, but more importantly, the president and the White House, they really are trying to focus Americans on what's happening up here. And what's happening up here really is dire. And, you know, you can look at it in two different ways. You know, warming temperatures and receding ice can be both a curse and a blessing. Here in Alaska, it's meant extreme weather, especially on the coast, false storms that wipe out villages, permafrost, no longer permanent, rainfall instead of snow. And that's really, there's a lot of impact on Alaska natives, most of whom live on the coast and depend on hunting and fishing, a subsistence way of life. On the other hand, less ice means open water and minerals and oil gas development for industry, and that's a good thing for industry, a longer, safer season and better transit routes for shipping. What has to happen at some point is the nations that are all involved in this, the eight Arctic nations, have to decide whether this is going to be a race for territory and a race for economic gain, or whether they're going to work together more in an Antarctica fashion and think about common resources and common good.
That was reporter Elizabeth Arnold in Anchorage. One stop on President Obama's tour of Alaska this week is the town of Dillingham. The president's expected to spend time there talking about how climate change is affecting local residents. Dillingham City Councilman Paul Liedberg knows about the symptoms of climate change. Mr. Liedberg, if you had a few minutes to discuss what you're seeing with climate change in Dillingham, what would you tell him?
Well, I guess the first thing I would tell him is how important the environment and intact habitats are up here to support the species that we have, specifically the salmon. And the habitat we have is one of the greatest assets for the region and for Dillingham. And the commercial salmon fishing in Bristol Bay has been going on for 130 years now. You know, salmon need two areas to survive. They need the rivers and streams where they hatch their eggs and are reared for a period of time. And then they need the oceans where they are maturing and growing. And warmer temperatures in the oceans will affect both of those. And that's a critical concern, I would say, to the region.
And what do you believe, what do the people of Dillingham believe Washington and President Obama can do about that?
Well, you know, if we could wave a magic wand and assure that the conditions remain in place to support the habitat that we have and the salmon runs that we have, that would be the thing that we would want.
Give us a snapshot of Dillingham. Tell us what the place looks like, because I'm talking to you from a very hot and humid northeast of the U.S. So the scenery sure. There is like, what does it look like?
Well, first of all, we're located in Bristol Bay, which is 300 miles or so to the southwest of Anchorage. We are a coastal community, so we get tides from the Bering Sea and from Bristol Bay affecting us here. It is flat along the immediate coast, but then just a few miles inland, we get mountains that rise up to the highest peak is about 5,000 feet here.
Mm. Have you lost any shoreline to erosion?
Well, we certainly have. I'm not sure that there have been real accurate studies that have been done showing exactly how much we're losing, but all one has to do is to travel down to the beach here, a couple miles from my house, either direction, and you can see constant erosion taking place. You know, that erosion is coming from a number of sources, from the water, from ice, from wind, from groundwater that seeps out through the bluffs. And with projections for more storms and higher sea levels related to climate change, we're certainly expecting that to not only continue, but probably increase.
Do you have any idea why President Obama is choosing Dillingham to visit?
Well, I think he has understood and certainly recognized some of the issues that I brought up and understanding that there are certainly threats to that economy, the economy of the commercial fishing. And I think he probably just wants to recognize that and gain better understanding of the region and what the region provides goes well beyond just our small part of the world.
Paul Liedberg, a city councilman in Dillingham, Alaska, one of the stops on President Obama's three-day tour of the state. Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's something that may have a lot to do with all that melting in the Arctic. Last year, the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere inched above 400 parts per million for the first time in human history, and we're only accelerating how much CO2 we're putting up in the sky. That's the easy part. Slowing down the accumulation or even reversing it is much harder. But the world's Ari Daniel tracked down an idea intended to beckon some of that CO2 back.
Here's the basic problem. Carbon dioxide traps heat in the atmosphere, and there's too much of it up there these days, about 40% more than before the Industrial Revolution, and the number's rising fast. So what if we had a way to suck the CO2 right out of the sky? Well, actually, we do.
As we walk under this array of tree canopies here in Atlanta, these are our best ways of capturing CO2 from the air. Trees have evolved over millions of years to do this very efficiently.
Chris Jones is a chemical engineer at Georgia Tech. Thing is, he says, we just don't have enough trees.
Globally, we are not reforesting right now, we're deforesting.
And Jones says that even if we planted trees everywhere we could, they wouldn't be able to pull enough CO2 out of the air to offset our emissions, which means...
we have to come up with a chemical tree that can effectively extract CO2 out of the air.
The technical name for this idea is direct air capture, and it's a tall order to improve on trees. In fact, some say the technology will never be efficient or cheap enough, to which Jones and some of his colleagues in the field say that's ridiculous.
People in the past said heavier than air flight is impossible, and all you needed to do is look at a bird, and you know that's wrong.
This is Klaus Lochner at Arizona State University in Tempe.
Capture from air, it's not impossible. All you need to do is look at a tree, and you know it's possible.
So I'm going to get up, and I'm going to get a show-and-tell item.
Chris Jones has a prototype of his technology. In his office in Atlanta, he holds up a ceramic cube half the size of a loaf of bread and almost as light, hollowed out by hundreds of tiny square-shaped tunnels.
If I hold it up to the light, you can see through it. And in fact, all of us who own a car own one of these. They're in the catalytic converter in our car. Normally, these are used to clean up the exhaust coming out of our engine.
The ones in our cars are designed to hold on to pollutants like carbon monoxide. The tunnels of Jones's cube are coated with a material his team's developed that grabs onto carbon dioxide. Jones has a pilot plant out in California where he's got 600 of these bricks stacked together.
So imagine a semi-tractor trailer stood up on its end. It's about the size of that.
The system uses fans to blow air onto the bricks and steam to remove the captured CO2. Altogether, the prototype sucks down about 1,000 tons of CO2 per year, an inconsequential amount by itself. But it's a start. Klaus Lochner's group at Arizona State is taking a different approach.
So here's some of that material.
Alan Wright helps run the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions. He rubs his fingers on a cream-colored piece of fabric. It's a material that bonds with CO2, and it's usually used to purify liquids like wine and beer.
It almost has a leathery feel to it. It's flexible and a little cushiony, kind of like a very, very dense sponge.
We literally used a pasta cutter to cut this thing in thin strips.
This is Klaus Lochner again, and he and Wright have turned that absorbent material into what looks like a duster, ribbons of the fabric woven into a central rod.
These are nature-inspired shapes, pine tree-looking pieces, where contact with the wind is very, very natural.
No fans necessary.
Our goal is to build devices just like a tree. They stand passively in the wind. And as the air blows over it, they absorb the CO2 out of it.
The idea is that ultimately, this CO2 will be stored or used elsewhere. Lochner says a full-scale version of this system, one with tree-like structures spaced out like a forest, is still 20 or 30 years away. But he says initial results show real promise. He estimates that eventually a square mile of artificial trees could suck up as much as 10 million tons of CO2 a year. That's a far cry from the maybe 1.5 trillion tons we need to take out of the air to reset our atmosphere. But again, it's a start. And lots of other people around the world are barking up the same artificial tree.
The technical challenge,
Chris Jones at Georgia Tech,
is to optimize the adsorbing material to make it more efficient and optimize the process so that we can reduce the overall costs.
Jones says it's his job to get the cost down to the point where policymakers have no choice but to say yes to this technology. That could take a long time, but Klaus Lochner says costs are likely to fall pretty dramatically.
Windmills, they were 40 times as expensive than they are today in the 1960s, and photovoltaic panels are 100 times cheaper than they were in the 1960s.
The first step was to show that direct air capture of CO2 was even possible. And that's been done.
We can reverse the CO2 concentration in the air. We cannot reverse the melting of a glacier. We are already way too late, but we will do it.
And the carbon dioxide will be waiting for us when we do. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel, Tempe, Arizona.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Latino students, they've got one of the highest high school dropout rates in the United States. But that's changing, slowly changing. And part of the reason for that is the subject of our next story. Here's Jean Guerrero of station KPBS in San Diego.
Sarabi Rodriguez was a third grader when she started prepping for college.
It's not, are you going to go to college? It's where you're going to go to college.
Her parents are immigrants from Mexico and didn't grow up with that mentality.
My parents didn't go to college. They have no idea how it works, like what's the Common App, what's the UC App, what are the different deadlines.
But then her mom heard about a college prep program from one of Sarabi's teachers. It's called the Barrio Logan College Institute, or BLCI. It offers free academic support and family counseling for navigating the U.S. education system. That was huge for this family. Sarabi's mother, Adriana, says she dreamed of sending her daughter to college, but she didn't know where to start. She says the BLCI program helped plug her into the steps needed to get her daughter to college.
De hecho, el programa te pide que hagas horas voluntarias.
The program asks you to do volunteer hours, to keep you involved in what they're doing here. More than a program, it's a second family.
The parents bring food to after-school study sessions and are there to see the admissions process up close. At BLCI, Adriana shows me her daughter Sarabi's large pile of college admission letters. The family is beaming. Sarabi got into the University of California at Berkeley. Sarabi's father, Oswaldo, is here too. He admires a picture of his daughter on one of the walls.
We came here with the American dream. We opened a restaurant, but unfortunately it didn't go well for us. It was a very difficult time financially, and it really affected Sarabi.
The family couldn't afford internet for a while, but Sarabi was able to use the connection at BLCI. Meanwhile, her parents say they got helpful workshops in financial literacy and parenting. Jose Cruz runs BLCI and says the family involvement aspect of the program is what helps make it so effective.
We capitalize on the Latino concept of family and use that as a bridge to the American education system.
Family-focused educational programs like this are more common in the U.S. as the immigrant population rises. But what makes the BLCI program different is how long it works with students and their families. The program selects students in elementary school and follows them through high school graduation.
All of us who work directly with the kids are of the first generation in our families to go to college. Our parents are immigrants from another country, and so we share that experience.
Cruz says the challenge is juggling the different problems that immigrant families can face. Sometimes families just can't put food on the table. Sometimes they need mental health services. BLCI is trying to cope by hiring more staff. But the Sarabi family says the counseling they got was more than enough. The youngest daughter, Emily, who's 12, is also in the program. She started with it in the third grade and is aiming for Princeton.
I think if I work hard in school and I follow my sister's path, I think I can make it up there.
Meantime, her older sister, Sarabi, is mentoring other students.
So you're thinking of doing law when you grow up?
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
That's Sarabi talking to Evelyn Sanchez. She's entering eighth grade. They're hiking along the coast, part of a field trip Sarabi helped organize for middle schoolers who didn't get into BLCI because of the program's limited resources. Evelyn says the hike made her more confident about college.
It really inspired me because Sarabi sounds like she's happy, like what she's doing. And when I grow up, I want to be like Sarabi, like happy what I'm doing.
Evelyn's parents are also from Mexico, like Sarabi's.
We want them to see themselves in our shoes and see that it's possible.
Sarabi says she plans to stay in touch with these middle schoolers until they graduate high school and continue inspiring them to go to college. For The World, I'm Jean Guerrero in San Diego.
People in Japan are not known for taking to the streets to protest very often, but they were out in big numbers over the weekend. Tens of thousands of people gathered outside the Japanese Parliament building in Tokyo. They're against proposed legislation that would allow Japan's defense forces more leeway to engage in combat. And that's a big change for a nation whose constitution forbids war. James Schoaf is a Japan expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's in Washington. These protests, James, have been pretty amazing, but isn't this legislation expected to pass anyway?
The protests have been very large by Japanese standards. I think that reflects
two things. One is the Japanese people themselves are tend to be anti-military leaning and strongly pacifist leaning, so they're not fond of anything that would get Japan more involved in military adventures. And the explanation has been relatively poor by the government about this broad package of bills. That said, the governing coalition has the votes to pass this, and they intend to pass it within a couple of weeks.
How would you describe those protesters? Just like you said, kind of peaceniks, or do they have another agenda?
In many ways, if you go back to 1992, when Japan was proposing legislation to participate in UN peacekeeping operations, there were very similar protests, claims of unconstitutionality. And over time, 20 years later, the Japanese public has been quite comfortable now with that role for the self-defense forces. So in some ways, this is a natural evolution of the public getting more accustomed or used to the fact that the world is an increasingly dangerous and unpredictable place, and the world is asking Japan to do more to contribute to dealing with those situations.
Should China be worried by this?
I don't think so. Japan's military budget is still just about the same level it was about 10 years ago. In the meantime, China's has increased three times, and China's military budget is much bigger than Japan's now. The way that this legislation is going to be implemented, and we should actually talk a little bit about what the legislation is, some little pieces of it will potentially allow Japanese forces to engage in combat, but in a very rare instance and only if Japan's national security is directly threatened. For the most part, these bills are about allowing the self-defense forces to provide logistical support to U.S. or other international coalitions in support of peacekeeping or response to a threat to the broader peace and stability. So this is nothing that's going to allow the self-defense forces to really engage with China or affect their interests unless China is directly threatening Japan.
So what is at stake for Washington here?
Well, Washington is certainly encouraging or happy with the changes and these new bills that are about to pass in Japan, primarily because they allow for a more integrated cooperation between U.S. and Japanese forces, either in defense of Japan or potentially in some kind of North Korea scenario, for example. Up until now, we've had to operate in very separate areas. U.S. would be forward area doing the dangerous stuff. Japan would be in the rear area where it was safe. And we coordinated, but we couldn't really leverage the tools and the assets that Japan has into a more integrated fashion. We should be able to do that more now, and we'll begin practicing that after the laws are passed. But overall, I think the U.S. is hoping just for more help in the region. Japan can now play a stronger role to address instability, which the U.S., I think, is going to be quite happy with.
James Shoaf at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A French pastry chef had a great gig working at a 5-star hotel in New Orleans. Then Hurricane Katrina cost him his job and his home, and he had to start over.
The life I used to have before and the life I have now is completely different. Maybe it changed my life for the better.
The story of Thierry Marceau coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's off the charts, and Europe knows it. 100,000 migrants arrived in Europe over the past month. Some are refugees fleeing war or persecution. Others are not. And as we'll hear in a moment, many of them get deported. So far this year, more than 340,000 people have made it to Europe, which is already more than in all of 2014. And while many migrants continue to arrive by boat across the Mediterranean, this past month has seen a new pressure point emerge in landlocked Hungary. Authorities there have been overwhelmed by the number of migrants trying to get across one particular border crossing. My colleague at the BBC, Nick Thorpe, has been at that border and has been speaking to migrants. Orient us, first of all, Nick, where is this border and what are conditions like there?
I am at the moment on the Hungarian-Serbian border, close to the city of Szeged. This is a place called Ruske, a place which is the favorite crossing point for migrants. It's become the favorite crossing point, partly because it's close to the main motorway, the main highway between, which runs right up through the Balkans into Hungary. So there's a huge amount of traffic on that. People coming up through the Balkans would often travel by bus as far as this border. Then they get off those buses and simply walk across the green border until now. Hungary has now built a fence, the deadline for completing that fence. It's a barbed wire structure for running 110 miles along the Hungarian-Serbian border, the whole length of it. But there are gaps in it where a river flows, where a railway line flows, and up those, through those areas, large numbers of people are pouring, about 3,000 a day, 50,000 by the end of today, just this month alone, 50,000 in August, 38,000 last July. That gives you a sense of the increasing numbers here.
Wow, that is just extraordinary. Tell me about any migrant that you met in particular whose stories really struck you.
There were a group of women and children from Kobani in northern Syria, obviously a town which has been on the front line of the fighting between the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Islamic State guerrillas fighters there, the Kurdish fighters there backed by US and other airstrikes over the past year. A city, a town which is almost completely in ruins now. We know that more recently fighting has flared up again. It's still in Kurdish hands. But yesterday in this field where they sit in Hungary, this surreal situation of people from Kobani sitting in a cornfield in Hungary as the sun sets, people there, the women and children, presumably the men had stayed behind to fight, but the women and children, no one spoke English, but they wanted to do something for me. So the children sang me a song from Kobani about the resistance of Kobani, part of the sort of legends of Kobani, which are emerging among the Kurdish people there, defending it from Islamic State at the moment.
Wow, what a scene. You're there in this field and these kids are singing you a song about Kobani, the city that's practically destroyed.
That's right, yes. Another example, people from Aleppo yesterday, a man in a suit, wearing a suit and tie, completely drenched through with sweat. We've had temperatures in 36 degrees centigrade the past days, well into the hundreds, lower hundreds Fahrenheit. And he had insisted, he was coming on crutches, he had a bad leg injury, he badly needed to see a doctor, so he was supported. I said crutches. In fact, it was a stick broken off from a branch as he'd come up through the Balkans. He said he was a doctor from Aleppo. He was sort of limping up the track, but had still kept the dignity of wearing his full suit, his tie. Not even the top button had been undone.
And finally, Nick, how active are smugglers in this area?
They are very active. You go through the motorway, the highway, petrol stations, gas stations next to the highway, and they're everywhere. There are pretty dodgy-looking people sitting at the tables. There are migrants hanging around the edges of the areas, approaching people, cars suddenly driving away very fast, some vehicles with no number plates. Sometimes a plainclothes police car will give chase. So again, it's a kind of game going on. It's almost become a sport. Often they're driving in convoys, decoy vehicles, to try and shake off any attempt by the police to stop them. But there is much more of a crackdown now. But the sheer scale of it, so much money can be made by the different groups. It's drawn the groups to here. And the people are very vulnerable to that. The asylum seekers are very vulnerable to it because they want to avoid police detention. They want to avoid the struggle to get onto the trains. They want to get to Western Europe as quickly as they can.
Nick, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
That was the BBC's Nick Thorpe. One place those migrants heading into Western Europe are eager to get to is Germany. Thousands of Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans have risked their lives to get there. But Middle Easterners aren't the only ones hoping to resettle in Germany. Many migrants from the Balkans are also making their way there.
We're talking about Serbia, Bosnia, Macedonia, Montenegro, but specifically Kosovo and Albania in particular in the past year.
Berlin-based reporter Sumi Somaskanda has been writing about this.
These are primarily what you would call economic refugees, so people who are fleeing simply poverty and poor economic conditions. And they're seeking better fortune in Germany and other European countries, and Germany in particular has been taking in more than ever before.
Yeah, and why is Germany taking in so many refugees, and what is the appeal of Germany?
Well, Germany, you have to remember, is Europe's strongest country, most powerful economy. While there have been economic crises in Italy and in Spain and in other European countries, Germany has remained largely unfazed. And people are aware that there is also plenty of jobs to go around when it comes to labor in Germany. And so, and you also have to remember that during the Yugoslav wars, the Balkan wars, there were a lot of refugees from the region who ended up in Germany. So the people who are coming now often do already have a brother, a father, aunt or uncle in Germany. So it's an obvious destination.
But now I gather Germany is starting to differentiate between economic refugees and political refugees. Where do the people from the Balkans who are heading to Germany, they're economic refugees. What's going to happen to them when they get to Germany?
So more than 99% of them are sent back. That's the bottom line. Germany has made that differentiation based on the Geneva Convention, and Germany's message is pretty clear. We will take in anyone who is fleeing war or persecution, but people who are fleeing poverty, we simply cannot take everyone in. So that's where the line is drawn. And anyone who is coming to Germany and sending in this application for asylum here, they're pretty clearly told that they'll be sent back. And there are buses that are chartered, there are flights that are chartered, and they've tried to speed up the process so that, refugees who are coming from that region in particular, it's quite clear that they know that within a week or two, they'll be sent back to their home country.
Yet what happens to them when they get back to the countries they're coming from?
Well, that's the question I asked some people from the region itself, and often they get back to, the same situation they left, which was no economic opportunity. Sometimes they go on and try again, maybe in a different country, because there have been cases of countries that have recognized asylum applications from this region, particularly Switzerland and France have. But it's also interesting to note that in Bosnia and Serbia, there are minorities that do face discrimination. And I talked to a member of the Organization for the Roma here in Germany, and he said, look, when some of these refugees go back, they are facing discrimination. Their houses have been taken away, or anything that they've had have been taken away. And that's a discussion that has started to gain more traction here in Germany, is what to do when maybe some of these refugees are not just coming for economic reasons.
Right. So looking at the actual cases themselves and kind of determining who is economic and who is a political refugee.
Exactly.
I saw that over the weekend, soccer fans in Germany held banners up that read, "Refugees welcome," but there are also many others who are not welcoming the refugees at all. How has the influx of migrants been received by Germans generally?
It's a really mixed picture, you have to say. Overwhelmingly, most Germans have opened their arms to the refugees, especially those fleeing war and persecution. You've seen volunteer groups organizing in local communities where their asylum shelters are cropping up. You've seen, donations and marches and messages of solidarity. But one of the reasons you've seen that outpouring is in contrast to the spike in violence we've seen. There's been more than 200 arson attacks on asylum shelters in the first half of this year, and that was more than all of last year. There have been right-wing protests. There have also been clashes between protesters and police that turned violent a week or two ago in Heidenau in the state of Saxony. And it was the first time after those protests that particularly spilled over that Chancellor Angela Merkel, stood up against the right-wing violence, because it was clear that it was starting to spiral out of control. And authorities are really scrambling to figure out exactly what to do to make sure that asylum seekers who are coming to Germany to seek shelter are safe.
Sumi Samaskanda, a reporter based in Berlin. Sumi, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Across the water from Lower Manhattan and the Statue of Liberty is Jersey City, New Jersey. It's a big place with more than 250,000 residents. About 40% of them were born outside the U.S., and more than half speak a language other than English at home. Jersey City has also adopted something else from abroad, a style of emergency medical services staffed by community volunteers. It's based on an Israeli system, as Jennifer Strong reports.
Jersey City already boasts one of the lowest urban 911 response times in the U.S. It takes under 6 minutes, on average, for an ambulance to get where it needs to go. But they've set an aggressive new goal: to respond in under 2 minutes. That's unheard of in this country, but not in Israel, where GPS software deploys two response teams at once, an ambulance plus people nearby who can help out until it arrives. The U.S. version of United Hatzalah, or United Rescue, uses that same software.
The difference between arriving in 90 seconds and arriving in 5 minutes is very often the difference between life and death.
Mark Gerson is the co-founder of United Rescue.
So the goal of United Rescue is to crowdsource emergency first response, to enable those who are trained and equipped to save lives to do so, and to be immediately followed by the ambulance.
Volunteers undergo 60 hours of medical training and agree to be tracked by that GPS software. The hospital in charge of this is Jersey City Medical Center. Robert Luckritz is the director of emergency medical services.
Not only do we have to account for how long it takes the ambulance to get to the home, but also how long does it take to get on an elevator and get to the 42nd or the 52nd, or now we have a 95-story building being built in Jersey City. So if there's someone on the 41st floor that's trained in CPR and emergency care, and there's an emergency on the 35th floor, we want to make sure that we can get them there quickly, because it can take time for us to get up into some of these high-rise buildings.
So far, the hospital is training about 300 volunteers. It also provides gear, such as oxygen, defibrillators, and other first aid supplies. New Jersey has Good Samaritan laws to protect the volunteers who help out, but what about protection for those who call 911 and find someone who doesn't work for a hospital at their door? Luckritz says they're taking that just as seriously.
We're putting them through all of the same process that any one of our employees go through. So we're performing a thorough background check. We're vetting these individuals, going through an interview process to make sure that they truly are the type of individuals that we would want to walk into our homes.
The push for this new service came from Jersey City Mayor Stephen Phillip.
Change is not always easy, and this is certainly a deviation from the way people have traditionally had responses to 911 calls. I actually think that this is eventually going to be regular practice in every major city across the country. And the reason I feel so passionately about it is because it just makes a lot of sense. The technology's there. It's not difficult to implement.
The software they're using to deploy community responders was created for Israel, but it's also being used in Brazil, Australia, and the UK. Phillip says it's pretty simple.
It's similar to what one would think on Uber or their Google Maps. Simultaneously, it'll route out an ambulance and will notify a United Rescue volunteer that the system recognizes is in the immediate vicinity.
Yet, given the many cultural and legal differences between Israel and the United States, one has to ask whether a program like this might end in lawsuits.
I think it's a great idea, bottom line.
Lee Goldsmith is both a medical doctor and an attorney specializing in medical malpractice. He says every restaurant in America has a sign about how to perform the Heimlich maneuver because it saves lives, and a choking person can't wait.
You cut the response time, lives will be saved. This should be done all over the place, and I do not foresee any increase in litigation anywhere in the United States.
Border to border, Israel has about 2,600 volunteers for their version of this program, with a nationwide response time of under 3 minutes. For The World, I'm Jennifer Strong.
Before we take a quick break, here's a follow-up to a story we had last week. You might remember we told you about a 50-year-old German fad. Not just any fad. This one involved people having their picture taken with a man in a polar bear suit. Apparently, this craze came about because the Berlin Zoo got a polar bear in the 1920s. And as a result, everyone wanted their picture taken with the next best thing. We posted some of those vintage shots at PRI.org. Our story prompted Nancy Scoyles Greenberg to send us a picture of her great aunt and uncle with the polar bear man. You can see that, too, now at PRI.org. It's pretty darn great. The bear is sitting next to Nancy's great aunt in the sidecar of a motorcycle. Nancy thinks it was taken in Nuremberg, but she's not sure. And that got us wondering, are there more of you out there with polar bear man photos? We would love to see them. If you have one or more, please share them by tweeting us at PRI The World. Or you can send a message by heading over to Facebook/PRI The World and clicking on the button that says Message. How science could keep your ice cream from melting so fast, that's still ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Raise your hand if you've ever struggled with a dripping double scoop of ice cream in August, or if you've ever seen a kid cry after the top scoop tumbled to the ground. Not to worry, scientists at the University of Edinburgh are on this. Kate McPhee is a biological physicist there, and her research team's come up with a way to keep ice cream frozen a little longer.
We're not talking about ice cream that doesn't melt at all. What we're talking about is ice cream that melts more slowly than you would typically expect from an ice cream sitting on top of an ice cream cone, for example.
Right. So how have you at the University of Edinburgh managed to keep ice cream frozen for longer? What do you do to it?
Well, we add a protein that comes from a bacteria. It's a naturally produced protein, and this is a friendly bacteria, so it's not one that can cause you any harm. And that protein stabilizes the ice cream and slows down the melting process.
What started this project in the first place?
We're studying this bacteria, this friendly bacteria, and we discovered that, well, it lives in a community, so it doesn't live as individual bacteria. It lives in a community of cells. And when it is in that community, it produces this protein, and that protein goes to the edge of the community, to the surface of it, and it protects it. And we found, we dubbed it a bacterial raincoat because it essentially becomes repellent to water. And that led us to believe that it would be able to then stabilize a mixture of oil and water so that oil and water would stay mixed. But it also made us predict that it would stabilize air bubbles. So it'd keep air bubbles stable and stop them from dispersing. And also that it could coat surfaces. And that's what you have in ice cream. You have an oil and a sugar syrup mixture. You have air in there to keep it light and allow you to scoop it up. And you also have the solid surfaces, which is the small ice crystals in there. And so our protein can stabilize all of those, which is why we tested ice cream.
Wow. Ice cream has this really smooth consistency, and I guess the fat molecules get really round when they're frozen. Do you still have that consistency when you change it like this?
Yes, we do. All we've done is we've replaced one of the fat components of ice cream with protein. It's there in quite a small amount, but it is there to stabilize the mixture of fat and sugar syrup and stop them from separating out. So when we replace this fat component with protein, then we should have pretty much exactly the same feel in your mouth.
Right. Are there other foods that could benefit from this bacterial protein?
Yes. So any foods that where you want to incorporate a lot of air and keep it light and fluffy. So, for example, chocolate mousses.
So as scientists, I imagine you have to test this ice cream a lot. How much weight are you people putting on in the lab?
We work on a number of foodstuffs in the lab, so our lab smells very nice indeed. But they won't let me taste it yet. So until we've gone through some of the regulatory and the safety issues, I'm prevented from tasting it. But I'll be onto it soon.
So how many extra minutes before that ice cream starts melting do we actually gain by this innovation?
Well, we can predict then we should be able to get all the way through an ice cream cone without it dribbling all down the sides, which I think will be a bonus to parents around the world.
Yeah, and all those kids who lost their second scoop on the ground.
Exactly, yes.
Kate McPhee is a professor of biological physics at the University of Edinburgh, telling us about an innovation that will prevent ice cream from melting so fast. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Not ice cream now, but still on dessert, sort of. 10 years ago, Thierry Marceau was the head pastry chef at a 5-star hotel in New Orleans. Then Hurricane Katrina hit the city, and Marceau lost both job and home to the storm, so he had to start over somewhere else. Monica Ortiz Uribe found him in New Mexico.
Hello, how many people?
French cuisine was hard to find in southern New Mexico before Thierry Marceau opened Le Rendezvous 8 years ago in Las Cruces. On a weekday at lunch, the place is packed.
Bonjour Simone, comment ça va?
As is his custom, Marceau wanders the dining area in a black chef's uniform and greets his customers. Simone Kaufman is halfway through a plate of beef bourguignon, but her thoughts are already on dessert.
I just came back from France. The pastry smells the same way, looks the same way, and tastes the same way. So that's good.
Marceau grew up in his father's bakery, which was in a ski resort in the southern French Alps. As a teenager, Marceau spent winters on the slopes and summers in front of an oven, training to become a pastry chef. When he finished school, a friend told him he could find work in the United States. That's how he ended up in New Orleans.
I arrived in New Orleans. It was Mardi Gras week. I feel like it was in a Disneyland here, you know? I mean, on the street, you know, drinking.
Eventually, Marceau ended up as the head pastry chef at the historic Fairmont, known today as the Roosevelt Hotel. The century-old landmark has hosted the likes of Elvis Presley and a handful of U.S. presidents. In 2005, it got a visit from Hurricane Katrina. Marceau recalls 800 people decided to ride out the storm in the hotel.
So I decided to bake pretty much everything I have in my fridge, you know. Mostly cookies, brownies, you know, stuff who have a chef life, you know. I'm not going to bake cream puff, okay?
Marceau also sent up hundreds of chocolate truffles to the guest rooms. It made for a festive mood in the hours before the storm hit. Overnight, the staff drank champagne at the hotel bar. But the party ended when the levees broke and the hotel basement flooded.
The hotel was dead after that, you know, no more air condition, no more nothing.
Outside the hotel, the floodwaters rose between 1 and 2 feet, enough to strand almost everyone inside. Marceau says some of the wealthier guests used their cell phones to call a private helicopter service that could pick them up.
It was getting so stressful, some guests, you know, they would pay anything to get out of there.
The hotel began to evacuate the remaining guests and staff 2 days after the storm. Marceau came back 2 weeks later and visited his home for the first time. What he saw was shocking.
I opened the door. It was so quiet. Like an atomic bomb, you know, and everything is dead.
That was the end of Marceau's life in New Orleans. A decade later, he's found refuge in an unlikely place.
Are the French fries coming?
His restaurant is in a strip mall, across from a Walgreens and a Subway. Not exactly where he imagined himself after working in a 5-star hotel. But when he walks from table to table each day, he's rewarded with warm smiles and familiar faces.
This lady over there, she's coming every day at 12 o'clock for the last 7 years. You know, you cherish that. It's something special, you know, and I never feel that before.
In New Orleans, Marceau served his pastries to the Saints' football players. In Las Cruces, he makes carrot cake for a pastor's 60th birthday party. He doesn't worry too much when his teenage kids go out with friends. And on Sundays, he plays soccer at a neighborhood park.
For the first time in my life, I feel like I established something here. The life I used to have before and the life I have now is completely different. Maybe it changed my life for the better.
Thank you so much. Enjoy.
For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
And that's The World today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. At skoll.org, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.